member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, all the chips in the PC and everyone listening. I had that in my head, and now I lost it again. Welcome to
It's always the way. Murphy's Law.
Murphy's Law. Welcome to Soundbite. I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Brian Meehan.
We have Linda answering the phones. She'll be running the show for us today. Both Dave and Nick are in their typical one step ahead of the law phase here, trying to leave me in a lurch. Fortunately, Brian was able to come in. Dennis got sick at the last minute. And we'll get through a show today, so feel free to call. The phone numbers are 966-JAZZ in the 585 area code, or toll-free 1-800-790-0415. Today is Saturday, the 4th of May, so what is that, Quattro de Mayo?
May the 4th be with you.
May the 4th be with you, yep. We had Pi Day a little bit ago. Actually, what is it? In 2015, we're going to have a really good Pi Day, 3.14159. So at 9 o'clock on Pi Day on the 15th. So today, this is Soundbites. We're going to get through your questions and talk about some news, generally have some fun. Nick is actually at the Imagine RIT big expo event coming down in at RIT this weekend, big technology conference. I always joke that RIT isn't that difficult to imagine because it's so big, and that falls on lame ears, of course.
we don't have a rim shot here.
Yeah. So let's get to our first news story that goes along with our poll this week. Google denies a battery draining location bug in Google Now for iOS. Google Now was probably the best thing to happen to Android mobile devices in 2012. Google's brilliant virtual assistant uses location, search, history, and other data to automatically present users with information they like weather, driving directions to meetings, travel times, when you should leave based on what the traffic is like, sports scores, and all sorts of cool information. Now, after a long wait, iOS devices now have access to Google Now. Earlier this week, when Google updated its Google Search app for iOS with Google Now functionality. But the arrival has been marred by two problems. First, the platform limitations on iOS and its sandboxing, and Google's decision to forgo push notifications make Google Now a little less useful on Android devices than it is on Apple devices, less useful on Apple devices than it is on Android. And secondly, an apparent bug in the app is seemingly causing location services to stay on all the time and drain users' batteries, which is a problem that Apple has faced with its geofencing and its Siri search function, that in order to know where it is, so if you say, remind me to get milk when I leave work, it has to have that geofence on and the GPS running all the time and location services running, which can drain the batteries. So the first issue of the iOS limitations can actually is fairly insurmountable because of the way iOS sandboxes apps. Apps don't get to talk to each other through the full range of programming. But the whole point of Google Now is it gives us all this great information before we even need to know it. And since the apps are very limited in what they can do while minimized or in the background, it's still going to be a little better on the Android platform. But we're hearing from a lot of people that really like the integration into iOS as well. The second issue with the battery design will probably be fixed with software. And now that more people are using Google Now, and it's enabling it in the Google Search app, it even keeps your location services alive while it's minimized, so it can know where you are and respond to what to things. So if, for example, one of the neat features it has is, say, you have a meeting at another location, it keeps up to date with traffic information, and it says, you know, if because traffic is heavy, you got to leave for that meeting now instead of in 10 minutes when you thought you might. So it's really neat to keep track of how much time it's going to take to get places.
But without a push notification, that usefulness kind of goes away a little bit.
So you have to leave the Google Now app open and keep looking at it yourself. So for those of you that haven't tried Google Now on iOS, it is available immediately in Google's free Google Search app that you can download from the App Store. And so that relates to our poll this week. Do you use Google Now? And the choices are, I love it, it's okay, nope, or it's just Big Brother in disguise, man. And if you go to our newly improved website that Nick has been working so hard on to get back up, www.soundbites.org, you can vote in the poll. And at the moment, I Love It is leading with 33%, followed by Nope with 30%. It's Okay with 20%. And trailing is It's Just Big Brother with 17%. And we know that you just love to comment. So underneath the poll, you can log into our forums for a poll for May 13. Do you use Google Now? Post your answers and your comments. We've had a few of those. So that is our question for this week. Give us a call. Do you use Google Now? Phone numbers are 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll-free 1-800-790-0465. Just like Linda from Greece has done. We'll take Linda now. Welcome, Linda. What's your question?
Hi, I could barely hear you.
Well, let's see. Maybe I had to crank my level up, too. Can we raise the level just a little bit, Linda?
Yep, I am now.
Okay. All right, how's that? No, now I'm, now I got to turn mine down a little. levers waving at us. Yeah. But can you hear us better now, Linda?
Not really, but that's okay. No, because usually, that's okay. I've got Google Now. Well, the phone I've got, which is the LG Optimus L9, it's got 4.1. They're telling me sometime this year I'll get 4.2, and that's when I can get Google Now. My Android phone does not take Google Now right now. That's want to let you know.
Okay, so yeah, that is an issue that we've seen in the Android fragmentation, that because there's so many different versions of Android running on so many different phones, that you may not get the latest features without upgrading your Android version, and you may not be able to upgrade the Android version if your carrier hasn't allowed it.
Yeah, they said the Optimus 9, which I love, is in Europe right now, but it's supposed to come sometime this summer. But that's okay. I got two questions. One, I've got an iPad, you know that. are you okay?
Yep.
And I get a strange message when I hit my mail button. It says, the server has failed, but yet I get my mail.
What mail service are you using? Who's your mail provider?
What do you mean?
You get your mail from Google or from Yahoo or from Roadrunner?
Most of it's Gmail.
Okay. We have been seeing this issue quite a bit with both Gmail and Yahoo mail servers.
Yeah.
What we are seeing and what we think is happening is that the services are so popular that they are, in essence, overwhelmed. There are only a certain number of connections each mail server can accept.
Yeah.
And so, say Google has 1 million connections available.
Uh-huh.
Well, if you're the 1 million and first person to try to check your mail, you're going to get a server error. Sometimes we even see the error is that can't connect to server, re-enter your password,
yeah.
which isn't the right error message. It can't connect to the server, and your password isn't going to matter.
Yeah.
Usually, just waiting a few minutes and trying again will let it work.
But the funny part about it is, I get my mail, but I get the message, but I still get my mail.
You might not be getting all of the mail. It may have got some of it in, but not all of it that was waiting for you.
But if I go to my iTouch, I have no problem.
Well, and that we think is actually part of the problem. So many people have smartphones and tablets and computers that you, as one person, are probably checking mail on 3 or 4 devices, and that counts as 3 or 4 people. And most people set their mail to check every 5 minutes or so.
Oh, no, I have mine manually.
Yeah, so generally what we're recommending is set it to manual. Or set it to like 30 minutes or so, and so it's not all tried to check at once. Because the other problem that we've seen happening is that if your iPad is checking for mail, and you tell your iPod to check for mail, so you have two devices checking at the same time, your account is busy from the first device, so the second device can't get in if it happens to be checking at exactly the same time.
But I have both of them set to manual, so they're not checking it until I do it.
Right, but what often you end up doing is you hit check mail on one device, something doesn't work, so then you go and try to hit check mail on the other device.
Yeah, okay, one more question if you'll allow. I want to put music from iTunes on an Android phone. What's the easiest way to do that?
It depends on the phone. Most of the Android phones can be mounted as a disk, a flash drive that shows up on your desktop. And then so you can just drag the song file from the iTunes window onto that phone icon. Usually, when the phone mounts inside that phone icon, there's a folder called Music. Are you a little familiar with Android, Brian?
Yep. There's an app available on the Mac and on the PC called Google Play Music, and you can download that, and it'll look at your iTunes library, read the contents of your library, and then share that information with Google Play Music. Your Android phone will then go and connect to Google Play Music with the same account and make that music available to you.
Okay, let's back up a little. I'm new to this stuff.
Sure.
So how do I get my Android phone to, wait a minute. My Android phone here, the Kinect thing I plug in to charge it with, does not have a separate thing where I can plug it into the USB port.
That's okay. There's no need to connect it to your computer.
Wait a minute. I'm confused then. How do I get the music from my computer to my phone without connecting it to my computer?
Step one is to install the Google Play app on your phone. You can get that from the Android store.
Okay.
And it looks, it's an orange icon, looks like a little set of headphones.
Oh, I think I've got that on my phone.
Okay, good. So you've got that part already.
Okay.
The second part is to download the program for your Mac or PC called Google Play Music Manager.
Google Play Music Manager. Oh, mm-hmm. Okay.
And
which is at music.google.com.
Yep. And when you see that running on your Mac or your PC, it's going to look at your iTunes library and recognize what music you have and share that information with your Google Play account. Then your phone will look at that information and then make those songs available to you.
So it works itself through the internet. You don't need to physically plug it in anymore.
It's a very similar service to iTunes Match.
Yep.
Okay.
So you basically, you install the Google Play on both of your computer and your phone, and then Google handles matching all your music, and then you can play your music from your phone.
Is there someplace on the internet where we explain this a little more? I know you guys know what you're doing, but I'm a little confused. And is there some place on the internet where I can get these instructions?
Sure.
On the Google Play website, music.google, or actually it's now play.google.com. It talks you through how to do it.
Play.google.com. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm confused with your new website. I'm sorry. Your new website's confusing to me.
We're working on it, trying to get it looking more like it used to and trying to get everything back up and running again.
Well, I'm glad you finally put April 27th back up there. Yeah, I go into Jazz 90.1 to get the shows.
Yeah, I'm actually that was something I was going to mention. Thank you for reminding me. If anyone has a copy of the April 27th show, the file that Nick recorded lost the last 20 minutes.
Oh.
So that's why I was waiting to put it up until I found if someone had another copy. But if anyone has that copy of that last 20 minutes of last week's show, send me an email, Steve at jazz901.org, and we can get a copy of it to update the archive so we have that last 20 minutes.
Yeah, so now, so I can play this. Do you know when today's show will be available?
Hopefully by tomorrow. I'll get working on it later today, and I usually get it up by Saturday night, sometimes Sunday afternoon.
Then I can play it over again and listen to what you guys had to say.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot, Linda.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Yeah, it's been interesting getting the servers back up and run, well, the new server running since the last server crashed, and we're working through the different software. And I know it's difficult because it looks different, and change is always frustrating for people. And it's been going. Nick has been doing a great service in the middle of everything else he's doing, trying to get the polls back up and the questions back up and whatnot. Do we have the time to take this before the break? No, all right, we'll try. So let's go to Bill in Brighton, and thanks for calling Soundbites. What can we do for you today?
Thanks for taking my call. A couple of weeks ago, there was a man who called in. He had taken a picture of his nephew, and he had put that picture on Flickr, and then Google picked it up, and his picture was on, his nephew's picture was on, was found on the Google search. So then he went into Flickr, he deleted the picture, but off of Flickr, but it was still appearing in the Google search.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's very difficult once they get indexed like that. Even though you delete it, it still appears on the Google search. Instead of trying to delete it, what he needs to do is pollute the data that's there. He needs to take that his son's or his nephew's name and index it to a picture of a landscape or a smiley face or something.
That's
an interesting
question, yeah. Keep
doing that a bunch of times, and then Google will replace what they have with that landscape picture.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to get around that.
Yeah, just keep you can't eliminate the data. Instead, just pollute it.
There is a way to report a picture.
Yeah.
Report inaccurate search results. Brian, you found something there?
Yeah, if you've got an image that you need to have removed, either for copyright or for family purposes, from Google's image index results, when you click on the full image, you can copy and paste, or copy the address from the top, and you can report that to Google, and they'll verify the claim and remove it. I've done that on a number of occasions and had pretty quick success with that.
Hey, that's great.
That's under support.google.com.
All right, and we'll get that posted. If you want to post it into our forums, that'd be great. We'll get that posted online, and hopefully that'll help other people. That music tells us that we're going to take a quick break here and listen to our wonderful underwriters who make this show possible. Again, you can give us a call at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, and we will see you on the other side of the break.
Computer.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Soundbites. I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Brian Meehan.
I'm Linda Wildman, filling in for Aunt Dave Enright.
And we have a lot of fill-ins for everyone today. This is the Soundbite show. We had a suggestion earlier.
I think that's great. Soundbite.
Yep. Okay, so we're back. Actually, let's just jump right back into the phones here. So let's go to Chuck from Rochester. Hi, Chuck. What can we do for you today?
Yes. Hi. What'd you say? I missed that.
Go ahead with your question.
Okay. you're a little fuzzy on my end for some reason. Anyways, I was doing some work yesterday on my computer, and I had what I thought was kind of a close call with a virus or something. And one of the questions I've had for a long time is, I do backups and everything, so I'm pretty prepared. But the one thing that I would really miss if I lost it because I was hit with something would be in Firefox or Explorer or Opera, my bookmarks and favorites. Is there any way that I can back those up?
Sure, your existing backup program should back that up for you. They are preference files inside your local settings folder in your home folder. So most people who back up their drive will back up their home folder, which is all your documents and your pictures. So if you just select, say, your documents folder to back up, it's going to miss it because it's in an invisible folder. You want to back up your home folder, which has everything in it.
This is what I was confused. See, what I use my backup for is just to basically individually, I do a lot of video work, so I'm individually taking chunks of video content over What you're saying is...
Okay, so you're not using a backup program. You're just copying files as you need
exactly.
to. Okay.
Chuck, what browser are you using?
Did you say which browser?
Yes.
Browser. That would be mostly Firefox.
Okay.
But I do use Explorer and Opera.
They all have an export bookmark command,
yep.
So you can manually back up your bookmarks too. But I think there's a couple of automatic ones, aren't there?
There are. As Steve mentioned, you can look into Bookmark Manager, and the button on the far right-hand side is going to be Export Bookmarks. And that'll save it as an HTML file, and you can import that into most other browsers. In Internet Explorer, it's a folder within your home folder called Favorites, and you can back up that. It's just a bunch of files. But the easiest way, Firefox, Chrome, I don't believe Opera offers it right now, is a bookmark sync function. When you sign into the browser using an email address typically, it will sync your bookmarks with their service, and then whatever your computer you go to, or if some incident happened with your computer, the moment you sign back in, your bookmarks will be available to you. And I know those can be really critical.
Where is that happening? I don't quite understand. It's happening within my browser?
The browser service, so Google offers it through its Google ecosystem. Firefox also offers it. It's called Firefox Sync. It's a plugin.
And then Apple offers that through their iCloud service with Safari.
Okay. Is there one for Explorer?
No.
Oh, okay.
Which is interesting because Microsoft Sync services are part of Windows.
Yeah, even the Windows, the SkySync, or Windows Mesh, it's not available in Windows Mesh.
You guys seem to really like the Chrome. Do you prefer it over Firefox?
In the early days, Firefox was one of the first real alternatives to Internet Explorer. A lot of times in terms of security and vulnerabilities. But Firefox was also small and lean and very fast. Over the years, Firefox has gotten big and bloated, and Chrome was the new browser that was really small and fast. So it's typically now a fight on how fast you can load pages. And so every time a new browser comes out, they say they can load pages faster, or they have a faster Java engine, or there's different benchmark scores on how fast they can load pages. But what's really nice about Google Chrome is that if you are using the Google ecosystem for Google Mail and Google Calendar, Google Drive for documents, Google Chrome has that all built in and will automatically sync your Google Chrome bookmarks into the Google service. When you work on documents on Google Drive, it will save them to your local computer. So if you're disconnected from the internet at some point, it caches your documents locally, and then the next time you connect back to the internet, it resyncs them to the Google Drive internet service. So it's very popular on tablets and on even the Chromebook because it syncs in with the rest of Google services.
The only reason why I haven't made the leap yet, maybe you guys can just give me your opinion on this, is I just assume if Google has their own browser, they're already so entrenched in tracking you for commercial purposes that I assume their browser is going to make it even worse.
That's part of the benefit of getting all their services for free, is that they can use that information to target advertising,
right,
and further their research of their purpose of indexing the world's information.
Okay.
So in Firefox, there is a service called Firefox Sync that will get posted into the forum shortly that lets you sync your Firefox bookmarks with the internet. So if you have Firefox on other devices, you get the same bookmarks as well.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, I see. I will definitely look into that then. The only other question I had real quick was, I mentioned I'm transferring videos over to my hard drive, my external often, and I have this ever-annoying THM file. It makes a duplicate of every video I have, this THM file, but it seems to be useless. I don't know what it is or...
It's a thumbnail.
Oh.
So that's probably what Windows is creating to display a thumbnail of the video in your desktop.
But it's completely, it just has its own icon. It doesn't have a picture.
Right. That file is used by Windows Explorer when you're viewing those documents on your desktop.
Is this a Canon camera by any chance?
I'm sorry?
Is your video coming from a Canon camera?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's created by the Canon software as a thumbnail and the information about your picture.
When I deleted it, it doesn't seem to have any bearing.
Nope.
It's the metadata?
It's metadata.
It's not embedded in the video? It's a separate file?
Yeah, you can also do... I originally thought it was for themes, but... because on the camera, you can apply some effects and carry that over. I had it on one of my old power shots.
Yeah, because in still images, the metadata is embedded in the image.
Yeah.
But on video, it has to be a separate file. So basically, the metadata is the name of the camera, you know, the camera settings, you know, your aperture, your focal length, the date and time, things like that. So you can go back and search for, depending on what software you're using, you can say, find me video that I took, you know, December 25th.
Right.
So it's more than just the date of the file. In still images, it's the EXIF data, the extended information, where you actually get your focal length and your aperture settings and your contrasts and all of the things the camera saves about that picture itself.
Okay, excellent. Just to go backwards real quick, then I'll let you go. How are other devices going to know that I'm using Firefox with the sync function?
You use Firefox on the other devices, too.
Right, which I would be. How does it know what my bookmarks are from my laptop to my one laptop to another?
You log in with the same Firefox account ID.
And that information gets stored.
That's new to me.
That information gets stored on a server at Firefox.
Okay. I've never done any of that before, so that's new. Okay, that's great. Thanks so much for your time. It's nice to hear a female Linda's voice on there today, too, and keep up the great work.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Yep. Yeah, it's sometimes a male-dominated industry here. It's nice to have a few women. There are a couple of women techs in town that I've been trying to get on the show, but she's a little too camera shy, I guess, is the right word.
We do have a text here. Is there a device that I can wirelessly send video and or audio to my HDTV, regardless of the CODEC from my Kodiak? Kodak. From my laptop.
A device to wirelessly stream media from your computer to your television. There are several different ones. Apple makes one called the Apple TV, and that integrates with all the rest of Apple's devices, iPad, iPhone, iOS, and computer. And it can send music and data from your iTunes library as well on your Windows PC as well. And then there's the Google, what's their Cubey thing that they announced?
The Google Cube, yeah.
Google Cube that isn't really catching on yet.
Yeah.
And then what was one you just found?
Intel's had a standard for a while called the WiDi, wireless display.
It's different than DLNA?
Yeah.
Because DLNA used to be the standard that people were supposed to use.
And I'm sure there'll be another one next year. It's a USB plug-in that would go on the back of your TV. And if you had a WiDi capable laptop or display, it would send that information wirelessly. Also, there's a USB plug-in for your laptop. Not terribly popular. Samsung televisions also have an all-share capability, which is very similar to Apple's AirPlay.
So that's a neat way to send the pictures you take on, say, your smartphone up to your great big television.
Yeah, I use the all-share feature on my Samsung TV at home.
Yep. The Apple TV box is $99, plugs into HDMI port on virtually any television. And again, even works with Windows PCs using iTunes. And there's actually some interesting third-party programs to give the AirPlay is Apple's technology for wireless video streaming, to give that to Android phones and to Windows as well. So, yeah, that's the big thing now. We're getting smart TVs plugged into the internet, so you can get like Netflix or Hulu from the internet on your television. But a lot of people have content on their phones and their devices. And many TVs have a USB port on the front, which you would then plug into your television to get that content in there. But it's nice to be able to do it wirelessly. It's much more convenient to do it wirelessly. Alrighty, while we're looking at the next phone story, let's, speaking of Samsung, let's do some news here. Samsung smartphones and tablets running Knox get the U.S. Defense Department approval. Samsung said on Friday that its smartphones and tablets running the Knox security management software have been cleared for use on U.S. Department of Defense network. BlackBerry had announced on Thursday that the DoD approved use of BlackBerry 10 smartphones and Playbook tablets on the DoD network. Samsung's Knox software currently runs in the firmware of the new Galaxy S4 smartphone, providing a series of security controls. The company plans to incorporate the software into other upcoming devices as well. Nearly all of the management and security capabilities of Knox require a special connection to the management server run by the IT shop inside the firewall, and the BlackBerry Balance software features require a BlackBerry device linked to the BlackBerry Enterprise Server 10. So basically, inside your division at the DoD, you would have these servers running. And then both the BlackBerry Balance and the Samsung Knox allow users to separate their personal data and their work data on a phone or a tablet. Therefore, if a worker loses a device or leaves the job, the IT shop can wipe the corporate data from the device without affecting the personal photos, games, or other data. Samsung recently said a full-featured version of Knox won't be available until later, and that is dependent on the server-side activities by distributors, including the wireless carriers. BlackBerry hasn't said how much its enterprise server activations are going to cost either. DoD approval marks the first time an Android-powered device has met the agency's security standard. Samsung plans to seek certification from other government agencies as well. So, does knowing the DoD has approved the Samsung BlackBerry make you feel like getting one yourself? Give us a call on 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll-free 1-800-790-0465. It has been really big in government for BlackBerry devices. They were sort of, you know, the king of business and government until iPhone came out. But there are still a lot of places using BlackBerry, and the new BlackBerry 10 seems to be going on pretty popular.
President Obama was the first president to carry a smartphone, and they had a specially approved BlackBerry device for him to carry.
Yeah, it's a little tricky with the president because the presidential archives basically have to record everything the president does for the presidential library. So the mundane tweet about, you know, what he had for breakfast is now going to be in the presidential library. Very crazy. So it's interesting to see what's happening in the smartphone world as new devices are coming out, and everything is bigger and better than last year. There's a new commercial out from Nokia that starts with a wedding, and it has a bunch of people on one side using what look like iPhones and a bunch of people on the other side using what look like Android phones, and one guy gets up with this giant tablet, which is probably a Nokia, you know, the Samsung Galaxy Note. And someone yells at him for getting out of the way and stop taking pictures with that giant thing. And so they do the bump thing, and oh, that's a one-trick pony. And then the other aren't you old for an iPhone? And then they all start physically fighting and jumping and beating on top of each other. One guy rips his shirt open. He's got a giant Apple tattoo on his chest. And then two of the catering staff pull out their Lumia phones running Windows OS. And, well, maybe they just like fighting. So really kind of an interesting phone commercial for those of us in the know. But that music tells us it's time to take another break and listen to some of our fabulous underwriters. While we're listening, give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415. And let us know what you think of the new Samsung commercials as well. And we'll be right back after the break. And good afternoon. We are back with Soundbite here on Jazz 90.1 FM. I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Brian Meehan.
Linda Wildman.
And we are hurtling headlong into the end of our first hour here. We did have a text that came in over the break asking about something that was mentioned last week with viruses on the iPad. And some of that is the way you define virus. There is a class of programs called malicious software that can do something malicious to your computer. Typically these days, they try to get your credit card information, or they try to trick you into installing software that you don't intend to install, and those are called Trojan horses. And then there are viruses where the key function of a virus is self-replication. It gets on your computer, it copies itself, and infects other computers from that. There have been malicious programs in the iOS store on the iPad, but there haven't been a specific self-replicating virus. Most of the time, the malicious programs sneak through Apple's vetting process. When a developer wants to release a store, an app in the iOS store, they submit the application to Apple for approval. And then Apple has this sort of black box approval process, and that's been a big complaint in the developer world, is they don't really know what Apple's going to say. There are certain rules that Apple wants developers to follow, and one of the big ones is that it shouldn't duplicate functionality of an Apple product. But then that rule has sort of been backing off because we have the Chrome browser, which duplicates Safari, and we have mail.
Any number of contact management apps.
Yeah, contact management apps and different mail apps. So they've kind of backed off on that one a little bit. But there have been malicious programs that Apple will catch and remove. There was one called Find and Call, where the app said it would find people in your address book and let you call them. What it didn't say is that it called them too, and in essence, we're sending spam to people in your address book. So Apple pulled that for not disclosing a feature. So the developers considered that a feature, but they didn't disclose it was doing that, and so it got termed malicious. There have also been a lot of cases of programs that were removed for ethical or taste reasons. There was the big one a couple years ago about Shake a Baby, where programmatically it was an interesting program because it used the motion sensors and the accelerometers in your iPhone to determine how hard you were shaking the phone. And the goal of it was marketed as a game. The goal was to get the baby to stop crying. So you shake it until it dies. That initially got approved because it didn't violate any of the legal terms of service, but it was just in such poor taste that they eventually pulled it back.
And yet there are still hundreds of flatulent apps out there.
Yes, it's okay to fart, but you can't shake a baby. So it's there are...
It's a strange world.
Yes, yep. There are antivirus programs available for iOS. There's one called Lookout, which is actually a security program rather than an antivirus, that also has an Android version as well. And what that does is it keeps track of your security settings. So if you are connected to an open Wi-Fi network, it will warn you. So you may not want to do banking or things like that. And then McAfee and Norton and several other companies make antivirus software for the iOS. But as a couple of callers later pointed out, that because of the sandboxing built into the iOS, which means that a program can't talk to another program unless it asks permission from the operating system. And when you install a program, it will tell you what permissions it wants. And you may notice that when you load a program, it says, you know, program, you know, say, let's say Skype wants access to your contacts so it can know who to call. So you can say allow or not allow. Some programs will hide features inside them that Apple doesn't catch during that vetting process. And when it does, you know, finally hit the, usually hits the blogs, you know, a day or so after a program is released, Apple can pull it back and remove it from the store. So the Norton Mobile Security is a lost phone finder, so very similar to Apple's Find My iPhone. There's a couple of games, there's one called Antivirus HD, which is a game where you're trying to kill viruses in a game. But an actual antivirus app is interesting to see how it might work to run on the iOS because it has to be a known malicious program for it to catch it. And they're not known initially. And as soon as they are known, Apple pulls it from the store. But you may still have a copy on your device.
And because of the sandboxing, an app couldn't go and give you a list of all the apps that are on the device.
Right. So one of the things that it actually goes to what we mentioned earlier with Google Now, because of the sandboxing, Google Now can't do some of the things on iOS that it does on Android. Where's that story? What are the things it can't do? The push notification. So it can't tell you ahead of time that you're going to be late for your meeting unless you leave now. You can just say, in 30 minutes before my meeting, give me a reminder, which is what Siri and the Apple calendar already does on the phone.
And that's kind of where some of the call is in bigger enterprise deployments of iOS and Android devices for mobile device management. Through the use of security certificates and apps, these applications, once they prove themselves that they are who they say they are, they can then inventory the device, report that information back to the internal IT department, and be able to make sure that malicious apps aren't being installed.
Right. And one of the big things we see in the corporate environment is the requirement that every device must be running antivirus software. And so we at my Mac shop, we run into often someone says, well, I have to buy antivirus for my Mac because the corporation requires it. Well, my thought is that if the corporation requires it, they should be buying it for you.
Hear, hear.
And okay, we'll sell you an antivirus program that may catch a Windows virus passing through your email, but there are no Mac viruses at the moment. And the malicious software that does exist for the Mac relies on Trojan horse and scare tactics, where a message will pop up saying you're infected. It's lying, but it will scare people into putting in their credit card information to buy a fake program that doesn't do anything other than make you think you're infected more and steal your information.
The most common one I see from day to day is the Flash Pro, a pop-up from a website. Hey, Flash Pro is available. And people are used to seeing so many Flash updaters for Adobe's Flash Player that they just assume, oh, there must be another update. They click it, and they are actively going through the steps to install malicious software on their computer unbeknownst to them.
Right, which is technically a Trojan horse rather than a virus.
Yep.
Intego has their virus barrier available, 99 cents for iPad and iPhone as well. And it says it stops viruses and malware from passing through your Mac, passing through your iPhone or iPad and infecting your PC. But it doesn't say how it does that. And I'm not that deep enough into the programming to know how something like that could work in the sandbox environment. So it's generally speaking, it wouldn't hurt to run. And then that was Nick's point last week. Generally speaking, it wouldn't hurt to run an antivirus on your tablet, especially or even the Apple tablets in addition to the Android tablets. They are all such powerful little computers that it doesn't take up much cycles. And better safe than sorry. It's good to be a good net citizen and stopping anything from passing through your computer. That it may not hurt your computer, but it may move on to someone else's and cause them trouble.
The life you save may be your own.
Yep. All righty. Never realized how hard a Nick's job is of talking all the time. I'm trying to grab a drink in the middle too. You had something you wanted to bring up?
Yeah. So I've been really excited lately with the current crop and how things are going in the world of 3D printing. I remember as a young student, a teacher telling me one day that we would have a microwave-like device in our homes that we would feed it a set of blueprints or download a set of blueprints to it, and within moments we would have that screw we were missing when we were trying to put the bed together and we were missing that extra screw. So I was talking about this with my wife last week, and she concluded that if we had a device like this in our house, we would have 72 hammers and 35 screwdrivers because that's what we can never find. Yeah. So if we had one, I don't know where the hammer is. Just go make one.
Yep.
But Staples now has announced that it's going to carry a 3D printer. And 3D printers have been available for a while from places like MakerBot, that you can buy these kits and download.
Yeah, they've either been very expensive boxes mm-hmm. that come pre-assembled or a box of parts that you assemble yourself.
For sure.
For $500, its prices have come down dramatically.
It's a bit of a hobbyist culture, but now for $1,300, you can walk into Staples and purchase one. And there's got to be a certain level of quality that a device has to have in order for a major U.S. retailer to be able to pick it up and sell it to any man who walks in through the door. Depends upon the retailer as well, what their vetting process is. But I'm kind of excited about this.
So we're beginning to see the results of the Star Trek replicator? Is it this
basically,
the
beginning,
opening door, the door of this?
Yeah, it can print three-dimensional objects. So yeah, a lot of at the Apple Cider meeting, we've had a couple of presentations on 3D printers. And a lot of the home kits are still a little fragile because both of the presentations we've had, when they carried the printer into the school, it didn't work when they got there.
There's some fine-tuning of necessary for it.
But it actually uses plastic filament. It looks like a really heavy gauge fishing line, and it melts it down and spits it out a print head and builds a physical three-dimensional object. And you can build it with working gears, with you can build a, an adjustable crescent wrench, and you spin the little thing, and the jaws open and close.
I actually have two of them at home. I have one that's a ball of gears that there's no seams anywhere. You couldn't ever take the gears out, but they're on axles, and all the gears mesh into each other. There's 12 gears together. And it's just like this brain of gears.
It's something you couldn't make.
You couldn't,
through traditional mechanical processes.
And then I have a flute that was made out of it, and you could actually play it with all these plastic springs in it and plastic parts. It's really, really exciting.
Yep. Looks like Staples is using the Cube 3D printer. The size of the object you can print is usually the limitation of the printer. So if you want to make a 2-inch by 2-inch by 2-inch because it's cubic print, that's the cheaper printer. I did hear about a car company that has a 3D printer that can print full sized car parts, at several feet cubed, and that's got to be a huge monstrosity.
That's got to be something neat to see in the parts department. Well, we'll make one of those for you.
Yeah. It used to be called rapid prototyping.
And that's where the ball of gears I had was from a local rapid prototyper.
Yep.
Would you guys buy one?
Yeah,
let us know.
Might be interested. So yeah, the goal is the Star Trek replicator type thing where you talk into the box and say, give me this, or upload a plan, and you get the wrench, you get the serving bowls, you get any physical object that you might want.
And you get something that's not quite entirely, but unlike tea.
Yeah. But I want to keep my friends. Do we have time?
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Paul from Pittsburgh. Hi, Paul. How are you doing today? What can we do for you?
Doing well. All of a sudden, my network card stopped working.
Oh, no.
I can't get connected. I've used other PCs and turned off, turned on, and everything else. But it doesn't seem to want to connect up.
Are you getting an IP address? Do you know how to look for that?
Yes. IP config, release, renew.
Yeah.
Seems to work.
And you're getting a valid IP address?
Yes.
Can you ping other devices or even ping your router?
Yes.
So ping is a very low-level function that talks over your network to say, can this computer talk to another computer? So you can ping the router. Can you ping your DNS or can you ping a public IP address? So that's the next step to see. It may be the DNS is not working, so you can't go to google.com in a browser. But if you typed in the address, the actual numerical address, it may work too. So the next step is to try to ping your own DNS, which is usually from your internet provider, or you can ping the Google DNS server, which is 8.8.8.8. That's easy to remember.
Yes. wait, call 8.
Yeah, you can do that at a command line in a
works.
DOS window. On the Mac, you can do it in the terminal window. Or on the Mac, there's also the network utility, which is a GUI version of some of these low-level networks.
This is Vista from the command line, and pinging 8.8.8 does work.
Okay, so the network card is working, your network connection is working.
So now it's a matter of whether or not your name lookup is working.
Right. So if you try to ping google.com... it will try to look up that name and look up what the address should be, and it may be your DNS that's not working. And so google.com should come back at 173.194.43.5. And that's why we use names, because no one can remember all of these numbers.
Right.
Do you get a response?
Is it just google.com or www.google.com?
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. They're technically two different computers, but it doesn't matter. And that will let you know whether your computer's name lookup is working.
That is not working.
Can you type the command NS lookup? That's all one word. N as in name, S as in server, lookup.
Okay.
And then just type the word server after you hit enter. You should get a response back from that.
All right, why don't you stay on the line, and we'll take a slightly longer break now, and we'll get back to Paul and his networking issues. So we're coming up on the top of the hour here at Soundbites on Jazz 90.1, and we'll be right back after these short messages.
Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon and welcome, everyone, to the second hour of Soundbite here on Jazz 90.1. I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Brian Meehan.
Linda Wildman.
And thank you to everyone for bearing with us as I take over hosting duties today. So we've got Paul on the line, having trouble with his network connection. And Paul, we left off with making sure that your name server is working. So with the ping command, we've determined that your network card is talking to the internet, but the name server is not looking up the name that you're trying to type in. So are you still with us, Paul?
Yes, I am.
All righty. So what did you get from that NS lookup command?
It was a DNS timed out.
All right.
That was NS lookup server, correct? Well,
close. NS lookup and then hit enter.
Right.
And then you'll get a little prompt that looks like a greater than symbol.
Yep. And then I got server unknown address 68.9.16.25.
What we're talking about during the break is sometimes when you're setting up your internet service, your internet provider will give you DNS IPs to type into your computer or to type into your router. And then that is what your computer uses to look up a name. So when you type google.com, your computer looks up the address itself, 173.194.43.14, and actually goes to the numerical address, because all the computers know are the numbers.
It's like a phone book.
Like a phone book, right. And so if your service provider changes their DNS, you have to change those IP addresses in your computer. And so what sounds like is happening is your computer is looking for a DNS that doesn't exist anymore.
Somebody's moved your phone book.
Right. So if you go into your Windows network network config and configure the network card, there's a section in there for obtain DNS automatically versus typing in the DNS entries. And you want to make sure that's set to automatic. And then you may need to log into your router and make sure the DNSs there are set to automatic. Because what happens nowadays is that when your router connects to the internet, your internet provider gives it the right DNS addresses. And then your router gives your computer the right DNS addresses. So we don't need to type DNSs anymore. But some people still have these settings typed in if they've been with a service provider for a while. The other thing you may need to do is flush your DNS cache, which I don't know how to do under Windows.
It would be restarting will do it, but ipconfig space forward slash flush DNS.
So the DNS cache is, it remembers websites you've already looked up in the phone book so that it can go there faster than looking them up again. And if it's looked up the wrong address, then you won't be able to get there again.
Okay.
So another thing you can try is in your web browser, if you type in the numerical address of a website, like Google, 173.194.43.5, that should always work. So the numerical address doesn't need a DNS lookup, and so by typing the address, you can get there.
Now, what was that Google address again?
173.194.43.5. Now, one of the things big companies like Google do is they have hundreds of servers across hundreds of IP addresses. So the Google.com lookup actually returns different IP addresses depending on what part of the country you're in, what time of day you're doing it, which is one of the reasons why they don't want you to type specific addresses, because right. they load balance across all their servers.
Okay. Well, I just tried that address in the URL, and I did get a Google banner.
So that's working. So your problem is your DNS entries are corrupted.
Okay.
So flushing the DNS cache, if you Google how to flush the DNS cache, that will give you those instructions, too, that Brian had.
Okay.
Similar sort of things can happen on the Mac as well, because it's all IP and Unix down at the bottom of all the OSs.
All right.
All righty. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
So it's terrible when your phone book gets confused. So you open your phone book, and it gives you the wrong phone number, and you can't get to the place you're trying to go to. So some of these low-level utilities like Ping and NSLookup make sure that the phone lines are working. So when you pick up your telephone, you hear a dial tone. So that's like Ping. You know the phone is working.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look in the phone book for the number, and if you can't get who you're trying to call, well, the phone book might be wrong. And usually when the phone is wrong, you get a message, you know, the number can't be reached as dialed. When you try to go to a web page that doesn't exist, the messages are pretty cryptic because they were designed by computer people.
Yeah, a lot of people get scared off when they see the messages on the screen. Immediately, the moment a message or an icon for an error pops up, it makes you just want to just stop reading and go grab a knowledgeable person and just say, come read this. Come read this for me.
Yeah. Especially some weird error messages. I just tried to go to a fake website, and there's somebody there. Oftentimes, the error messages you'll get will be because you misspelled the address. For a long time, I don't know why, but I was spelling Google, G-O-G-G-L-E, instead of G-O-O-G-L-E. A lot of bigger companies will register misspellings of their own name.
Typo squatting,
yeah. So that if you misspell, especially if you have a difficult company name, when someone misspells your name, they'll get to you also. But sometimes you can get to a website that doesn't exist, and you'll get a sort of a different message, you know, URL not found, or I just did it on Safari, can't find server. And so Safari can't open the page because it can't find the server.
And that's all a browser's going to know. It can't do that low-level troubleshooting for you.
It doesn't know if it can't find the server because the internet connection is down or the DNS is down or you misspelled it. It just knows it can't get to that server.
On a Mac, you've got a nice toolkit to work with the network diagnostic utility.
Yep, and that will try to diagnose connection issues. Where do you get that now? Usually when there's an error trying to connect to a website, the diagnostic utility will pop up. Can you get to it from...
Can you hold option down when you select on your Wi-Fi? That'll give you Wi-Fi diagnostics.
Wi-Fi diagnostics, yeah. Where is network? Network diagnostics is in system preferences under utilities, under network.
Okay.
It pops up automatically when it finds it can't make a network connection, so that's kind of a nice thing. It tells you to check your cables at both ends. We tend to have to tell you, and restart router. So it tries to help through connection issues to see where that connection fault is. And one of the things we run into a lot more now is because we're using tablets and laptops on Wi-Fi, your computer has a Wi-Fi connection. So that connection has to be on. You have to be connected to your Wi-Fi router. Your Wi-Fi router has to be on and connected to your internet router. Your internet router has to be on and connected to its upstream internet service. So there's four or five links in the chain, and if any one of them breaks, you can't get on the internet.
Let's throw a wireless printer in there while we're at it.
Right. And so that tends to be quite an issue. For a lot of people, and what I've seen recently in the Mac, especially in System 10.8, when you wake from sleep, it may take 15 or 20 seconds for the wireless connection to reconnect. So if you had, say, your web browser window open when you put your computer to sleep, you open the lid and the web browser is going to give you an error message that it can't connect to the internet because you're not connected to the internet yet. But in about 5 seconds, you probably will be.
And then panic sets in.
Then panic sets in because you're not and you get an error message you're not expecting. So on the Mac, we have the little Wi-Fi menu in the menu bar. It looks like it's radiating radio waves, but I know people who call it the snow cone. It looks like a snow cone, little black waves. And the more black bars you have, the stronger your signal is. So it's very much like your cell phone. And when you wake your computer from sleep, you may see that line flash as it's reconnecting to the Wi-Fi. When your computer's asleep, it's asleep. It shuts down the hard drive. It shuts down the network. It shuts down the radios. So it's asleep to save power. So that may take 15, 20 seconds to wake back up again. And so don't panic when you get one of those connection errors immediately. Wait a minute and try again. Firefox has an interesting message. Well, this is embarrassing. I can't restore your Windows.
Google Chrome's is, I can't find your page. That's all I know.
And Safari just gives you a generic can't connect to the server, which is the accurate command.
Yes, that is correct.
So they're trying to give some humanness to the...
Yep. Mm-hmm. Something went wrong. I don't know what it is. Sorry, I can't help any farther. Very strange. We had a story a few years ago where a caller had called in and they were writing code, and in Safari, it just displayed the code. But in Firefox, it displayed the page the way they expected. And so we're helping the caller out, and we're looking at the code. And Nick finally saw there was no end HTML command at the bottom of the page.
So Safari was doing it right.
Safari was doing it correctly and displaying the text of the code.
Unhelpfully, but correctly.
Firefox was looking at and saw a begin HTML and then didn't see an end and said, oh, I bet he meant to put an end in, and displaying the page. So Firefox was doing it wrong, but giving you the answer you wanted. So it can be frustrating that way sometimes. Whether you want it right or you want it correct. So it's... Computers don't do what you want them to.
They do exactly what you tell them to.
Very, very rapidly. And they can make mistakes much faster than you can yourself. Alrighty, so it looks like we got another caller coming in. While Linda's punching buttons, I will read the next news story here. Amazon accidentally leaks the world's first small-screen Windows 8 tablet. The first ever small-screen Windows tablet made a brief appearance at Amazon.com yesterday before quickly being yanked from the online store. While Acer was busy showing off a smattering of large-screen Windows devices in New York on Friday, the 8.1-inch Acer Icona W3-810-1600 left elbow was briefly available for perusal in the digital realm. And why does this matter? Because all of the current Windows 8 tablets thus far released have been 10 inches or larger, as Microsoft's operating system was engineered before diminutive tablets like the Nexus 7 and Kindle Fire became all the rage. So Microsoft has tweaked a bevy of features and the specs since the release of Windows 8 to create a friendlier environment for the smaller slates. The OS hardware certification program recently dropped the minimum allowable screen resolution from 1366 by 768 down to 1024 by 768, the typical resolution of a 7 or 8-inch tablet. And while leaked builds of the impending Windows Blue update sport a Snap feature that works fine on tiny tablets, previously Snap only worked on larger displays. As far as the Acer Icona goes, the rumors of the 8-inch tablet first surfaced last May. It's still yet to make an official debut, but the Amazon page revealed that the tablet packs a dual-core Atom processor, along with numerous other technical details you couldn't care less about. We'll undoubtedly hear more about the Acer Icona W3 and presumably a multitude of other small tablet Windows slates in the next few weeks, but give us a call. How desperate are you for an 8-inch Windows tablet? Call us at 966-JAZZ, that's 966-5299, or toll free at 1-800-790-0465, just like Paul did from Canandaigua. Hi, Paul, what can we do for you today?
Hi, I have a question about saving web pages. I collect antiques, and a lot of unique items go by on eBay and other auction sites. And I've been saving these pages for the last 15 years. But in recent years, it's getting harder and harder to save a complete page. I will save a certain page on eBay in Internet Explorer, Firefox, and Chrome, and they'll display the page differently. And when I save it, certain items won't be saved. others will be. So, sometimes one browser does a better job on a page than another. And I'm wondering how I can get around that. And also, if I've been saving my the pages I save, I've been naming them by the browser that I've been using to save them. And I find that if I open a Firefox save in Internet Explorer, I get hash.
Yeah.
It's really strange these days, and I'm wondering what happens in the future. Maybe Firefox will change and my files will be not, you know, badly displayed also. It doesn't seem like people using the universal code or standards or something.
Well, there is the HTML standard, but the wonderful thing about standards is there's so many of them to choose from.
Okay.
and so each browser is saving things a little bit differently. And sometimes it will save the page with links to the stuff on the page, which is great until the other end removes those links, and then the page won't open anymore.
Yes.
Safari has an option called Web Archive. I'm not sure about IE or Firefox. It's the Web Archive includes the page, and it also downloads all of the linked content. So text and images and content on that page are also downloaded to your computer. So it can open and display them again without getting all that hash. But probably the only sure way to make sure it looks the same again is to save it as a PDF or take a screenshot of that window. And that way it's not actually HTML code. It's a picture of the window as it looked, so you can get back and see what that picture was again.
And the PDF page will have your links in it.
It will, because I've noticed some... There are thumbnails, and then you click on them to get a larger image. Chrome will save the larger image and the thumbnails, but you'll click on the thumbnails and nothing happen. Firefox, everything works fine. So I've been saving individual pictures as separate units myself.
And that's what can happen when you're saving it as code. But if you save it as a picture, then you should be able to see that picture again later on. The problem that we'll get back to after the break is that code changes. And so if you want to hang on after during the break,
sure,
we can do that. We'll hear from more of our sponsors. And the rest of you can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. 1-800-790-0415. This is Soundbite. Welcome back to Soundbites. This is Soundbites on Jazz 90.1. I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Brian Meehan.
Linda Wildman.
And we're just grooving to the music here between callers. We've got Paul on the line who's having trouble saving web pages to his computer. And Paul, the biggest thing is code and code changes. A lot of times when you go to a website, there might be four or five completely different types of code. The web server asks, so you're running Internet Explorer, I'm going to give you all this code. Or if you're running Chrome, I'll give you this code. And so quite often, when you save the code designed for one browser, it doesn't look right in the other browser. Because each browsers have defined their own ways of doing things and their own ways of executing the standard instructions available.
Okay.
So the problem becomes when you want to save a page... It's easy enough to save a picture of that page, but if you want to save the links on that page, that becomes much harder. And those links may not exist anymore. You know, something like an eBay sale item, after the sale is over, the links may be removed from the website. So you try to go back 6 months later, and there's nothing there anymore.
Yes.
Yeah. So saving the page as a PDF or just a screenshot, which is... what does that come out to on Windows now? Is it a BMP still? On the Mac, it's a PNG.
JPEG after Vista.
Yeah, so
it's usually a lower resolution type thing where some of the photos on those auctions are nice.
Screen resolution.
It's screen resolution, yeah. If you could save as a PDF, then you get the higher resolutions.
That's found in the Save As menu, PDF?
On the Mac, it's built in. On Windows, I think you have to add a program.
You'd have to add a PDF printer. PDF Creator from SourceForge is probably your best bet.
Right. Yeah.
PDF Creator.
If you can always buy the actual Acrobat professional program from Adobe, but that's probably overkill for creating PDFs.
Yeah, I think I've got Nitro. I think was one. I don't know whether that.
Yeah.
Nitro PDF.
Yeah, that could. I think I remember hearing about that one. So if you Google PDF creator for Windows, or just print to PDF, you should be able to find a couple of different programs to do it.
Okay.
Does Chrome handle that automatically?
Chrome will save. Chrome will print to PDF automatically, and it will save it to your Google Drive if you would like.
Okay, well, that sounds good because I use Chrome too.
Yeah.
I've also noticed that I think when I check a save page, if I'm connected to the internet, it works fine. But I found that when I disconnect from the internet, none of the links, certain links, don't seem to create their pictures again.
Right. So it's not saving.
It's sneaky that way. You think you've got something, but you don't.
Yep. It's not saving the contents of the link. It's only saving the link. So you have to be connected to the internet to get back that link.
Yeah, because certain saves I get in Firefox work fine, just like they do on eBay. Yep. You click on the thumbnail, everything works good, and it'd be nice to have it that way rather than a separate page.
I've always wondered that about the Safari Web Archive function. How many levels deep do the links go? Yeah, it saves your current page and probably all the links on that page, but those pages have links, and those pages have links.
Right, you go forever.
So it'll fill your heart.
Safari has that, and you said Firefox or Chrome has Web Archive also?
I think Chrome does also.
Chrome has print to PDF. I'm not sure. It has a save as web page complete, as does Firefox, which will pull down images. But even something as simple as saving an email message out of Gmail, the actual page you get is not the same as that archival quality that you're looking for. Save for a stone tablet and a chisel. PDF's going to be about as close as you're going to get to that.
Okay.
But even then, it may not save the
high res.
And the length of links you want.
Right.
Because.
That's what I've been doing is actually clicking on the link and saving what's there also to the general folder with everything that has to do with that page.
Actually, one interesting thing is archive.org.
Yeah. I've used that a couple times. I spun up a computer running Windows 3.1 and brought up the website in Windows 3.1 of my old company as it looked in 1995.
Yeah, archive.
Yeah, I've tried that too, but it's just the general stuff that they can't possibly save all of eBay.
Yeah.
Individual eBay auctions.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering why they don't make some of those available too.
Yeah, limited disk space, probably.
Is there such a thing?
Well, we say disks are cheap. You get a terabyte hard drive for only $100, but
right. The government has got some big hard drives, I'm sure.
trillions of terabytes a day are probably created, and so that's.
Oh God,
they
seem to save them all.
Yep.
For advertising.
And we talk about Google Search. Google uses hundreds of petabytes of drives to store its Google Search archive. So it's interesting. Uh-huh. And how far back can you go?
Suppose this. Lots of times I come on, I'll say, an auction site. And it has a basic page which has like 50 lots with a thumbnail and a brief description. And then you click on something in each individual lot to go to a larger page. Now, the Web Archive supposedly would take that page of 50 and then go down one level and also save the individual larger pages?
Maybe, but depending on what auction photo hosting service you're using, like if you use Octiva or Flickr, depending on which service is going to be depending on how the images come out. Each one does it a little bit differently.
Yeah, well, these are like Sotheby's and Christie's, which use Octiva. They have their own.
Right.
So it might go one level deep at least.
Sure, you have a little bit more limited scope there, and you might be able to more predictably see how that'll work.
That would save a lot of time. Okay, well, very good. I don't want to keep you guys any longer. That seems like a way to start, but I'm sort of in trouble a little bit.
Yeah.
They don't want you to save this stuff, I guess.
Well, the web is so dynamic and changing that what you save today doesn't exist tomorrow anyway.
Yeah, that's why I'm saving it.
because
it's once-in-a-lifetime stuff on some of these items, and it's there for a week on eBay and gone forever.
Yep. Actually, this past week was the 20th anniversary of the web on April 30th, 1993. CERN, the European Nuclear Research Consortium, released a statement that made the World Wide Web available publicly, royal-free and free, created by a British physicist, Tim Berners-Lee, in 1989. And CERN published the very first website is available now again. So at info.cern.ch, the very first website ever created is now back online again for people who are interested to see what the web looked like way back then. And Brian found a page about what happens on the internet every minute. And he's posting it up now. Why don't you tell about that?
Sure. So it's an infographic that talks about what goes on in one internet minute. And just a couple statistics from here. 30 hours of video are uploaded every minute. And 1.3 million videos are viewed through YouTube every minute. 277,000 people log into Facebook every minute, while 6 million page views happen. 61,141 hours of music are listened to on Pandora. $83,000 in sales through Amazon.com. It's staggering to think about what it means when one of these websites is attacked. If something happens to LinkedIn's website, there's 100 new LinkedIn accounts that are created every minute. Twitter has 100,000 new tweets every minute. So just 1 minute of that website being offline has a fairly substantial impact to the people that use it and to the people that run it.
Yeah,
I'll be posting that up in the show notes.
Yeah, pretty interesting. All righty, let's go back to the phones, and we have Lynn from Clymer on the line. Hi, Lynn. What can we do for you today?
Oh, I just thought you might be interested. I heard recently that an organization from Austin, Texas, is going to make available throughout the world the necessary drawings for manufacturing guns of various types, and they're going to cash these in different countries all over the world once they get them produced, so that no government can say that their population cannot have guns.
Yeah, the 3D printing of guns has been a big controversy lately. That it's what technically constitutes a gun, in the firing chamber. Right now, most of the 3D printers are using plastic resin, and don't stand up to very well to actually gunfire the explosions in a gun. But there are some 3D printers that use metal, and as technology progresses, it will be more and more common. I remember the big controversy in the 80s when the first Glock pistols came out that were mostly plastic. And could get through metal detectors, but technology always tends to outrace social ethics and legal issues as well. But this is an interesting concept about weapons that have been lost. If you're a weapons collector, a lot of weapons have been lost to time, especially during the war, where you know something may not have lasted very long. I've been watching the Sons of Guns TV show on one of the learning channels, and they do a lot of restoration of old weapons. Someone brought in an M36 tank destroyer, and turned out it had an M1 barrel on it, so they had a real hard time getting it functioning again. I've got a 90mm gun in my backyard now. and they had to find a breech block for it that turned out to be from a Panzer tank. And so it was technologically interesting getting all these pieces together. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, when somebody's trying to restore something like that or trying to bring back something from the past, it's always metal fabrication. We have to build one of those things. And that's kind of what the ultimate goal of 3D printing is, you know, you don't have to use a lathe or a forge. You just push a button and it comes out your 3D printer.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. It's going to make things very complicated for those that want to get rid of guns, though.
Yeah, it's an interesting controversy. I've always wanted to learn how to shoot because of the mechanics and the skill involved. I try not to get into the political mess of it. I like watching the Top Shot TV show on one of the learning channels. I watch a lot of different learning channels. Discovery's got me sucked in.
Well, for me, it's the part that interests me at my age is I just don't want to see our country destroyed, and I think if we lose our guns, our country's history. And
yep.
I guess that's all I need to say about that. My real question was, This past week on the radio, I heard a lady talking about a search engine, and they are developing a secure email program, totally secure. They're going to have the servers outside of the country in the Netherlands so that all the passwords and everything are secure as far as our country is concerned.
Yeah.
And I suppose they're going to do it the opposite way for, we'll say, the Netherlands. They'll probably have servers here for their passwords and everything. But I was just wondering what you know about this. I think it's called Start Mail or Start Page Mail. Have you heard anything about this?
Not specifically. Let's look it up here. Any mail server existing can be secure. In fact, that was a big thing that Gmail just did a few months ago, is that all your Gmail connections are now secure over the Internet. So it's encrypted on your machine and decrypted on their machine. So no one can tap into your mail in transit. But if Google gets a subpoena, they can choose whether or not to honor that subpoena and turn over information. And so far, what we've seen is that most companies, when served with subpoenas, turn over the information the subpoenas are requesting, because that's the law in the U.S. So a lot of companies have started putting servers overseas and trying to deal with the laws in that country as well. So that, mm-hmm. that becomes a little trickier on how to work it that way.
Well, I would assume that they'll probably put, for Europe or something, those servers will probably be in this country, I would imagine. I don't know, but I was just guessing.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe you guys had actually heard more about this, how secure it was and how quick it's going to be out. My understanding, it's a paid service. I don't know if it's everything is encrypted or whether it's just when you choose to have it encrypted that it is. I just don't mm-hmm. know all that about it.
Well, technically secure, we already have. Legally secure is the question. And there are, in essence, extradition treaties between countries already, so that, you know, if someone's in the Netherlands and we want access to their server, you know, our police talk to their police, and they get it.
I got to be a little nervous about Start Mail, the company you're referring to, running from the folks that make startpage.com, the secure search engine. You know, all the links to Start Mail are broken. Or all the links, excuse me, the start page are broken.
That may be because of the proxy server here at school.
Okay.
Well, no, you should get a proxy error. Since we're inside the Greece School District here, we're going through their proxy server to stop the students from going to YouTube and Facebook and places yeah. like that. But yeah, one of the things that we've always said is that you can have technical security and you can encrypt your mail between you and the server, but if there's a subpoena, then the contents of your internet usage can be read by someone with a valid subpoena. And in fact, what we've been seeing is cell phone usage, or something called the pen register. What's the word I want? It's not subpoena. What's below a subpoena? Court order. That if the police want to know what your phone calls are, they have a portal with Sprint and Verizon and AT&T, and they can track your phone number very easily because the back doors are required to be in place. And the FBI was complaining about Apple's iMessage system a couple of weeks ago because
that's right.
it's encrypted and secured at your computer, and they can't tap it.
Just so, you, me, and the good folks at the NSA.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Lynn, for your comment, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about those types of issues in the future. And we're coming up on our last segment here on Soundbite, and we'll come back right after this message. Give us a call, 966-JAZZ, that's 966-5299, or toll free at 1-800-790-0415. Be right back. And welcome back to Soundbite on this fine Saturday afternoon on Jazz 90.1. I'm Steve Ray.
I'm Brian Meehan.
I'm Linda Wildman.
And we are entering our last segment here for the week. Hopefully Nick and Dave will have solved their issues and be back next week. And hopefully I'll be here next week too. Last week, I had sent Nick an email that I was going to be gone, and Dennis was filling in, and could he swap donuts with me? And apparently, Nick never got that email.
No donuts.
Because I was listening to the beginning of the show last week before I was out of range of the station, and I don't have cellular in my car, so I couldn't listen live. But yeah, no donuts last week for them. Poor guys. Let's get right back to the phones now. We have Joe from Cheektowaga. What do you know, Joe?
Well, I really feel for that guy that wants to save his web pages, because so many websites are assembling the web page using JavaScript. So that means, so you save the basic code. You ain't got nothing, because they go and they make other requests with JavaScript to fill in the page. It's just so annoying.
Yep. When the web was first getting going, and even up to a few years ago, almost every browser has a command called show the page code. And you could look at the HTML code and see how somebody did something and learn. Well, nowadays, when you show the page code, it's one line that says call, and that's the end of it. It's all PHP, it's all Java, there's hardly any HTML anymore.
Yeah, that and replacing good old-fashioned hyperlinks with, again, JavaScript.
Yep.
You click on this div, and it does something special, like fill in another part of the page or open a new window.
Or record where you're going from and where you're going to.
Yep. Oh, boy, yes.
Yeah, so it makes the web more dynamic, but it also means it doesn't work well on older computers or with limited RAM. Doesn't necessarily work on tablets because they typically have smaller processors. That was one of the big things with Flash, where Apple never wrote Flash for the iPad and iPhone because it was such a battery hog. And it did Adobe did make Android Flash for a while, and people that tested it saw their battery life decrease by 30% to 40%. And it didn't run very well anyway, because tablets typically have lower class processors than desktops, and Adobe eventually abandoned Flash for Android as well.
So sure. And unfortunately, the only way, as you were mentioning, to capture the page really, and it's going to be without links, is to take a screenshot of it. Anything else is just going to be sort of kind of getting most of it, maybe not all of it.
Yeah.
Unless you have. But the other annoyance that you were talking about earlier is the server errors you get when you go to visit a web page, and it just can't.
Yep.
I'd like to get every single browser author in the world together in one room and say, "What the heck are you doing? What you're doing is, like, I'll make an analogy. I'm coming to you with a toolbox full of screwdrivers and hammers and wrenches and pliers. I'm going to take away everything except the pliers. Yeah, I can pound in a nail with a pair of pliers. You know, I can.
And who hasn't used a pair of pliers as a hammer
from my 3D printer?
And I can, you know, I can turn a nut with a pair of pliers and so forth. But gosh. Why are you dumbing this down so much? Please tell me. Connection reset by peer. That means I know that everything up to connecting to the web server went okay. It's just that the far end decided, well, I'm not ready yet. I'm going to disconnect you. You know, don't tell me server unavailable. Don't tell me web page unavailable. It's like, tell me what actually happened. You know, DNS lookup error. They figure if you don't have this information, it's going to be too confusing. You know what? It's 10 times more confusing scrunching everything down into a single error.
Yeah, half the time it's too confusing for novices, but not enough information for programmers to figure out what went wrong.
Good gravy. I just don't get it. It's like, you know, tying my hands behind my back, blindfolding me, and you know, tying me to a post and say, yeah, sure, okay, good gravy.
And when we're trying to troubleshoot someone's issue, you know, I can't open a web page, and what's the error?
Page that cannot be displayed. I want to smack the guy inside Microsoft that came up with page cannot be displayed. And then it gives me 10 things that, you know, are basically useless to try and figure out what to do about it.
Yep. Yeah, very.
Must be Uncle Joe's Story Hour. No.
Have you checked the expiration date on your milk?
Yeah.
And I know the one caller did not like the Google ecosystem, figured it was tracking him too much, but Google does have a service called Google Bookmarks where you can keep all your bookmarks on a page, and they even provide you a JavaScriptlet that you can put in your normal, you know, favorites bar or whatever it's called, and click on it, and it will automatically save the URL of the page that you're viewing to Google Bookmarks. Then all you have to do is visit your Google Bookmarks page, and you can get all your bookmarks there. And that would be basically independent of browser.
The problem is that's part of the iGoogle system that is going away. Was it the end of this year or end of next year?
Yeah. There's another service that's very similar to that. It's called Xmarks. It was originally called Foxmarks, but then they moved it out of just Firefox. And what Xmarks does is syncs across platforms. So it's compatible with IE, with Opera, with Safari, Chrome, Firefox. And you can have the same set of bookmarks across multiple browsers, multiple computers. They offer a free tier and a $20 a year tier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be good if they were able to stay around, but yeah, it requires them to have financial support to, you know, do all the back end stuff.
And in a pinch, if you can't get that plugin installed, like maybe you're on a work computer and you don't have the authorization to do that, you can visit MyCloud or cloud.xmarks.com and just see a web page that has all of your bookmarks on it, similar to what you've seen in the past with Google Bookmark.
Wow, yeah. Oh, gosh, I didn't know that was going away. Thanks for telling me that.
Yeah, last July 2012, Google announced they were retiring iGoogle in November 2013. So we've all forgot about it by now.
Oh. Well, I do remember seeing that. I did not know that it included Google Bookmarks. Oops.
Yeah, Notebook was just the recent victim of the hatchet from the folks at
Google has had a lot of products that they've either acquired or accumulated from other companies, and they sort of languish for a while, and sometimes they get pushed into the limelight, sometimes they get slowly dissolved. When a company buys another company, sometimes it's for their product, but sometimes it's just for their engineers, and the product goes away, and Google Labs is where a lot of this other stuff tends to accumulate inside Google, and there's always enough people using that feature to complain when it goes away, but not enough for them to keep putting resources into keeping it alive
or to monetize it. A lot of and Google's not the only company that does this. I'm sure Apple does as well. A lot of services are feeders for other services. For an example, a while back, Google had the Goog 411 service that you could call and it would do 411 lookups. And that was a feeder for things like Google Now to be able to get voice heuristics and be able to learn voice, the same as the Google Voice project is now, able to get information and statistics to feed its other initiatives.
Oh, I think that was one of their main builders of their transcription service. They were training their text-to-speech on that.
You betcha.
All right, Scott, well, thank you for your time, gentlemen.
You're very welcome. It does look like there is the Google toolbar that has bookmarks in it that will sync with other computers running the Google bookmark toolbar, and that may be separate from Google Bookmarks in iGoogle. I'm looking at a page here on the Google Help.
Man, I forgot about that.
So that may let you save your Google Bookmarks across browsers. Let's see. I'm trying to find out. That may just be in Google Chrome, though, because I don't see. No, it's when you log into your Google account on any browser, you'll have a wrench icon, and you can add bookmarks into that. Alrighty, let's move on to another call. Let's go to Jason in Altoona. Hi, Jason. How you doing today? What can we do for you?
Well, having listened to you guys on the radio for the last 10 minutes, I think I've got plenty to add. Yeah. the guy who was trying to save the pages, I'm actually in the process right now. I've got about 14 links open. I'm doing research on one topic and trying to find all the all-inclusive websites about this one topic. And I realized if I really want to do this right, I need 14 screens, and that's not going to happen. So the best thing for me, print them out. I hate to say it, but hard copy is probably the best way to save this stuff, because at least that ain't going to be dissolved by an EMP either.
Right. But then you have to print each sublink page you want, too. You remember when computers were supposed to bring about the paperless office? I think they've actually generated more paper.
Or save time.
Yeah.
Don't forget archival inks and archival paper.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, there you go. So those industries have cropped up now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And the thing with the Google bookmarks, or the bookmarks in general, I was going to say... I was going to add about the X marks, but then somebody else came up with that idea. And I just wanted to say that I do use them. I've been using them since they were Fox marks, so that's a good almost 5 years now.
Yeah.
I think they've got a little bit of longevity. And, of course, yeah. iGoogle was there for how many years, too, before they decided to can it, too.
One of the neat things about X marks is it syncs between browsers. So you bookmark Chrome on one machine, and it shows up in Firefox on another machine.
It's the only one I know that'll go back and forth between Mac and PC browsers to IE.
Right, and it, like you said, it crosses all the different browsers and all the platforms. So, I mean, it's great for that. It was actually... picked up by LastPass, the company that owns LastPass.
Oh, yeah, I see that on their website.
And they have a deal. If you want to get both of the premium services, it's $24 a year for both. It's either 20 or 24. I can't remember what it is, but it's a little bit cheaper than what the two individual plans are separately together.
Yeah, 2 billion bookmarks backed up and synchronized.
But... with the X marks, it's really nice because, like in my case, anytime I have a problem with Windows, which, as you guys know, is anytime you turn it on, just format the hard drive, reboot, install Firefox, and log into X marks, install the plugin, and wham, all my bookmarks are there just like I had them configured before I formatted my system.
That's really, really neat. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for sharing.
And finally, the reason why I originally called was to just say I'm glad to see the website coming back. I was kind of afraid that its demise was going to lead to your guys' decision to retire.
No, that'll never happen. We're only at 23 years. We got a few years left.
And he doesn't look a day over 25.
Yeah. All righty. Thanks a lot for calling. So that music tells us that we're at the end of yet another show here. We'd like to thank all of you for listening. Thanks to Brian for coming in and help filling in. And very, very, very big thanks to Linda for helping run the board and keeping us on track today. We'll see you all next week. And thank you, and thanks for listening to Jazz 90.1.